right, we're ready for chapters 44 to 47. The screen says we're actually going to back up and get 43 because we didn't get through it last time. And so this is our outline of the book of Genesis. We're in the last section, the descent into Egypt. And that begins at chapter 37. We'll come more to that in just a moment. I'm going to forego the review of our chapters with the exception of the very last ones as we get to chapters 42 and 43. And we haven't covered 43 yet. We're about to do that. So we've got some ground to cover, 43, 44, 45, 46, and 47. We're going to see if we can do that. But anyway, chapter 42 has to do with Joseph's brothers go to Egypt and they return without Simeon. And so he's been left behind for security and or surety to ensure they're coming back. And we'll say more about that here in just a few moments. This is something we've looked at each time. I've added one more verse to that, and that is watch for evidence of God's providence throughout this series of not only the book of Genesis, but particularly from chapter 37 on. I've already mentioned to you chapters 46 and 3. We'll flag that in a few moments. Next week we'll get 50 and 20. We've already flagged it once. And then we're going to mention chapter 45 and verse 5 in our study in just a few moments when we get to chapter 45. But watch for evidence of providence, of God working out His purpose and even using some evil that men have done to accomplish His purpose. Or perhaps not only evil, sometimes He's using the customs of the people. We'll flag a couple of verses on that before we get through in our study tonight. Now, just a little reminder, Jacob and his family are here at Hebron, and they make their journey all the way down here to Egypt, which is some 200 to 300 miles. And we mentioned last week that may take 2 to 3 weeks or longer to make one trip and then to make that trip back again. So they've already made their trip down, left Simeon. They've gone back home. They're going to go back tonight taking Benjamin, and then they've got to go back and get their father. So quite a bit of traveling between Hebron and Ramses, Egypt, in our study tonight. More about that map here in just a moment. So let's get underway with chapter 43 now. In chapter 43, we have Joseph's brothers go back to Egypt, and they're taking Benjamin back this time. Now, some time has passed since the events of chapter 42. How much time? We don't know. We're not told. And evidence that some time has passed is found, first of all, in the fact that they've run out of food now and need to go back. So some time has passed. And then verse 10, Judah argues that we could have been there and back by now if you had sent your son with us. How much time was that? I don't know. The text doesn't tell us. So let's get underway. Verses 1 to 7, Jacob tells his sons to go back to Egypt. And they're doing that because we're in the midst of a famine. 2 years have passed, as we're going to see a little bit later. Has the 2 years passed at this juncture? I'm not sure. But by the time we get to chapter 45, 2 years will have passed. But anyway, we're well into this. We have more time to go yet on this famine. And so he says, go back and buy us a little grain. And Judah spoke up and took the lead, saying that the man solemnly warned us, unless you bring your brother back, you'll not see my face. And Judah argued that if you don't send him down with us, we'll not go. We're not going to go back. I'm going to have to paraphrase some of these sections. And notice at verse 7, what does he argue? What's his point? You better, and I'm going to paraphrase, you better send him with us and we better go, or he won't be coming back and we're going to die because we don't have any food. And so he's not coming back. And that was it back up at verse 5. But now verse 6 and 7, Jacob began to argue, well, why did you do me wrong by telling him that you had a brother? And their argument was that, how did we know that he would do this? He just asked us, is your father still alive and do you have another brother? And how did we even know that was going to develop? Now, Judah persuades Jacob. Now, we mentioned last time there were two brothers that seemed to have a little bit of sympathy, and I may emphasize a little bit. Reuben mentioned earlier, and this time, and we saw Reuben back not only in chapter 37, we saw him in chapter 42, and we see Judah this time, as we saw also in chapter 37. So what is verses 8 through 10? What does Judah say to his dad? Again, we don't go. We could have done been there and back by now. We're all going to die. So send him with me, and what does he say? I will guarantee his safety. Yeah, I'll be a surety for him, and you blame me forever if I don't bring him back. And so beginning at verse 11, Jacob told him, all right, you go. There didn't seem to be any choice here. We're going to die here. So you send him off. I'm going to send him off. You go back. But do this. Take you some presents with you. Take your vessels. Take some of the best fruits. Take a little balm, a little honey and spices and myrrh and pistachio nuts and almonds. And then take double money. And then the money that was returned to you, take that back. And go back to the man. And perhaps it was an oversight. And take your brother and go back. And then he says, may God Almighty give you mercy before the man, and may he release your brother and Benjamin. And then he says, what? If I'm bereaved, and some translations add of my children, if I'm bereaved of my children, I'm bereaved of my children. I don't have much choice here. And so send him back. He's in a bind. And so he sends him back. So now beginning at verse 15 through verse 34, Joseph and his brothers come to the house for a feast. Now it begins to get interesting here. When they come in and Joseph saw that Benjamin was with him, what does Joseph command his servant to do? Yeah, go make a feast at my house, not where he's seeing them at the moment or where they're coming, but take over to my house, to my residence, over to wherever he is, part of a palace. He is second in command, so he's not living where the king is, where Pharaoh is, but he obviously is in a quite to-do place. So take them to my house, prepare and slaughter, and make a meal ready for them, and I'll have a meal with them at noon. Now, as the men, notice verse 18, the attitude of the men. They're frightened. They're afraid. They're afraid that maybe Joseph is, they don't know who he is at this point. Maybe he's setting a trap. Maybe the money that was sent back was, that they're going to blame us for it, and he'll seek an occasion against us and fall upon us and make us slaves and take our donkeys, and maybe that's what's going to happen. So this is interesting at verse 20. They tell the steward, and I can just see them kind of, sir, I don't know if you know, but we had our money back in our sack. And we got back and we found the money in our sack, and we don't know how it got there. And what was his response to that? Yeah, don't worry about that. I had your money. I was the one that put it back in there. I had your money. And then he brought Simeon out, which should have been a symbol. You're okay. You're all right and you're in good standing. And so when they came, he washed their feet, etc. In other words, gave them greetings. And then at verse 26, when Joseph came in, they bowed themselves down to the earth before him. That's the very thing that was in the dream that they said they'd never do. And so he asked about the well-being of the father. He saw Benjamin. And what reaction did Joseph have when he saw Benjamin? Verse 30. He first asked, is this your brother? He knew it was. Is this the brother that you mentioned? And they said, yes. And he knew it was Benjamin. And at some point, he has to go away and weep for a little bit. And then he comes back in and tells him to serve the bread. Now let's talk about verse 32. He sat in a place by himself, the text says, and the Egyptians were who ate there or by themselves, and then the Hebrews by themselves, and then this commentary is given that it was an abomination for the Egyptians to eat food with the Hebrews. Now, what's that all about? Well, a couple of matters. Willis who argued that there was a feeling of superiority of race of the Egyptians over other races and other nationalities. And so one of the things was that we are superior, much as people used to think, and hopefully that's much better that the white race was superior to any other race. And so we don't want to associate with you because we are of a superior race. So you eat over there and we eat over here. But there was another matter perhaps involved, and that is that the Egyptians had different eating customs. And one of which was that they did not eat meat, particularly they had a custom about not eating meat, and that they would not eat of some of the meat that the Hebrews would eat of. And so consequently, because of those customs, we're not even going to associate with you. You eat your meal, you do your thing, we'll sit over here and we'll do our thing. So a couple of reasons for that. But I want to flag a verse here that we're going to flag one similar to it in just a few moments. This is another case of providence, perhaps. That, remember, God seems to be trying to get them out of Egypt. Now, God could have put food in, in Canaan. God could have given them food in Canaan and left them there, but they were assimilating into the society and being influenced by society. Remember, Judah and Tamar is a classic case of illustrating that. And so he gets them out of this land where they're assimilating into the land and puts them in another land, and you would think they're going to assimilate here. Not as easily. Because it was the custom of the Egyptians to kind of push people aside, and we're not going to have anything to do with these Hebrews. Now, there's going to be more evidence of that a little bit later, but I'm flagging that verse as perhaps a providence passage. God's going to use the customs and perhaps even the bad attitudes of the Egyptians to protect his people. Does that make sense? Are they going to be influenced by the Egyptians? Well, when they come out, they bring some idols with them. Sure, they're going to be influenced by them. But not like they were in Canaan, and not like they will when they go back to Canaan. Does that make sense? So you say, well, are they having influence? Yeah, they're going to be influenced, but not the assimilation into society is not going to be the same as it was in Canaan. And so God's using something here, I think, to accomplish his purpose. Now, we'll flag another verse along that line a little bit later. Now, beginning at verse 33 and then verse 34, this is something that had to surprise them. What does, seemingly Joseph was behind this, not just his men, his servant. What does he do? He sets them by order, by birth order, from the oldest to the youngest. And the text says, the men looked in astonishment at one another. In other words, how did he know our birth order? How on earth did this man, this Egyptian, know which one was the oldest and which one was the youngest of all these boys? And remember, they're getting on up in some years now, so there's some time has passed since he's seen them, and they don't know that this is their brother. And so they have to be astonished at how on earth did he know that? How did he know the birth order, and how did he get that right? And perhaps that's a test that he is performing before them. Now, one of the things that was quite noticeable that the brothers took note of is when they get their food, he got five times as much. All right, questions or comments on 43? We're going to move on. All right, let's go to 44 now. Joseph seeks to keep Benjamin in Egypt. This, again, is God's tool. God is using Joseph and his working as a tool to eventually get them into Egypt. And we're going to say more about that in a moment. So now, chapter 44, this gets interesting. Joseph seems to be testing their character. Have they changed? We flagged that in 42 and 15. If you want to go back and take a look, I'm not going to do that at this moment. But Joseph had his cup put in Benjamin's sack and then commanded the servant to follow after them. So he told them as they get through with this meal, fill the men's sack, put their money back in the sack, and put my silver cup in the mouth of the youngest. And then as soon as morning came, he sent his servant off and said, go overtake them and ask them why they did this evil. It's all an effort to bring him back. And at verse 5, he said, is not this the one, you asked them, is this not the one that the Lord drinks from and indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing. Now, there's two things about the cup. This cup is significant because this is the very cup that the second in command it drinks from, and you took it. That was, they didn't really take it, but the accusation is that of the servant is, what are you doing with this in your sack? It's a cause to bring them back. And then the second thing was that that would be like someone going to Washington and coming away with the vice president's personal coffee cup. And what are you doing with this? This is one he drinks from. And so what do you mean by this? You're in big trouble. The second thing is, this is the cup that he uses for divination. Now, we'll say more about that at verse 15. So let's just hold that thought. That was what the servant was going to say. So we'll come to that at verse 15. Now, starting at verse 6, the brothers are brought back. So the servant goes and overtakes them, and they're upset about this, the charges that are being made. Look at verse 8. Said, look, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan that was the money we found, and how could we steal silver and gold from your Lord's house? How could we have done that? We were honest men. We brought money back that was put in our sacks. Notice the rashness with which they speak. Verse 9. What makes us think they're being rash? Say what? Yeah, let him die. The brothers seem to be assured that the cup's not with them, I'm assuming. And so the man you find it with, let him die. Well, that ain't going to work too well because they found it in Benjamin's sack. And so they're just rash there. Look at verse 10. And he said, now let it be according to your words that with whom I shall find shall be my slave and you shall be blameless. I'm going to keep this one for my servant and my slave and y'all go back home. And so they searched every man's sack, and they found it in Benjamin's sack. And then the brothers tore their clothes, and they loaded their donkeys. They had to all go back to the city. Now, at verse 14 through 16, the brothers fall before Joseph, and they offer to be his servant. Now they're begging. And now we're going to come to this divination at verse 14. So the brothers come, and they fall before the ground. And Joseph said, what deed is it that you have done? Do you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination? Now, the cup had been mentioned as the use for divination. What is that about? Well, it was a pagan practice of pouring some substance into a cup. And various scholars talk about various things that were poured into cups. Some talk about pouring water up on oil and then seeing what it does and then interpreting that, like looking at some tea leaf and then interpreting what's going on. There's no indication that there was any divine revelation in that, but it was a pagan practice. And so you pour water upon oil, or sometimes pour oil up on top of water, and look and see what it does, and I'm getting the message as the way it turns, and this is what that message is telling me. Others talk about putting water in the cup and then sprinkling silver and gold, and then the movement of that would give them their direction or their answer, and they thought God's, like a God, lowercase g, was speaking to them through that. Now, did Joseph do that? Well, if Joseph was using that when God had directly been speaking to him, something seems out of order here, that God's speaking to Joseph and God's working through Joseph and God is interpreting dreams for Joseph, and then Joseph is using this pagan practice somehow. Some have suggested that's how God communicated with him. There's no evidence of that. That was a pagan practice. So what's really going on here? The answer is, I don't know. It very well may be that he was trying to not suggest that I use divination, but perhaps trying, as Willis suggests, he's trying to intimidate his brothers. I know what y'all are doing, and I have means of knowing. Now, he has a means of knowing that through God, but by them having the cup, a cup that is often used for divination, he's perhaps trying to intimidate them, letting them know, I have a means of knowing what's going on with you and what you've done. Is that the case? I don't know. He may have simply been intending to merely represent the vessel as something sacred. You took something sacred, like a divination cup. I do not believe that Joseph is trying to say, I practice divination. I'm just not convinced of that. You may be, have at it. I'll let you have at that. I'm just not convinced of that.
I wonder though if they were convinced of it because he had sent
them
in order according to their age.
Yeah, I have no doubt that they must have wondered, this is the cup he's used to determine our age, and he must know something about what we've done in the past. Because when he put them in jail, remember, for 3 days, put them in prison for 3 days, that's when they begin to cry out, we've done something wrong. And this guilt is coming upon us, chapter 42. Very well may be. So verse 17, he told them he wanted to keep Benjamin. I'll keep Benjamin here. Now then, beginning at verse 18, Judah comes to his defense. What happens in 18 to 34? Yeah. Don't do this. Keep me, do whatever. I've got to take him back because our dad back home. And so basically, beginning at verse 18, he reverses a kind of a speech of how we got here. Here's how we got to this point. Here's what happened and kind of reviews all that history that we'll not go back through in interest of time. And he said, our father said, bring us a little bit of food. I'm reading at verse 25. And we can't, but we can't go if our youngest brother's not with us. That's what we told our father. And look at verse 29. But if this one also is taken from me, the calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my gray hair in sorrow to the grave. Now that must have rung a bell with Joseph. They don't know they're talking to their brother, but they're saying, your daddy is going to die and go to his grave in grief if we don't take Benjamin back. And so that gets us down through verse 34. Any questions or comments? Down through verse 34, or at the end of chapter 44. Verse 33, he made the plea, I stay instead of the lad, go with me. How old is Benjamin at the time? I don't know. He's better than 22 years old because it's been 22 years since he's seen his brothers. So perhaps late 20s, mid 20s, late 20s. I don't know exactly how old he is, but he's at least that old and older. All right, let's start at chapter 45 now. I'm trying to make our way to 47. Joseph reveals himself and sends for his father. At this point, Joseph can hold back no longer. And so he tells everybody to leave the room. This is a family matter. I'm paraphrasing verse 1. Everybody else get out. This is a family matter. Let me talk to my brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians heard that. And then he says to them, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? Now, they had to be kind of amazed when he set them by order. But this has to amaze them too. How does this man know our brother who's disappeared? How'd he know his name? How'd he know that name? This must be some evidence.
Do you think Joseph didn't know until that point that dad was still alive? But I can't remember what he asked them specifically. He asked them about.
He had asked them earlier, they said he was living. Did he believe them fully, or did he think they're lying because they had lied to dad about him? I don't know. I just don't know the answer to that. Now pay attention to this right here. But he said, is my father still alive? But they could not answer him. They're silenced. They're stunned. For the first time, they recognize this is Joseph. For they were dismayed at his presence. The New International, the Holman Christians say they were terrified. The Lexham Research Lexicon says they were horrified. Now you think about the look on their face when they're standing there, and what we had just seen is that Judah is arguing, we can't leave this brother. Keep me instead. And then Joseph finally breaks down and says, everybody leave the room. Let me tell y'all something. I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? The look on their face. Uh-oh. This is our brother. Now, something else he did that was not customary for an Egyptian to do to a Hebrew, he asked him to come closer. Come near. Verse 4. I am Joseph, your brother whom you sold into Egypt. If they didn't know before, they know now. This man's telling the truth. This is our brother Joseph. Now immediately, verses 5 to 8, what does he say? I know what I would have wanted to say. You've been evil. You've been terrible. I'm going to throw you into prison. You deserve it. I'm going to let y'all die and rot in prison. That's not what he said. Yeah, he said, don't be angry or grieved. He ought to be angry at them. Don't be grieved or angry with yourselves. God sent me before you to preserve life. That's one of our verses to flag of providence. God was doing this. This goes on through verse 5. For these 2 years of famine, so we've got five left, God sent me before you to preserve posterity on the earth and to save your lives by great deliverance. And so it was not you who sent me, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh and the Lord of all of his house and the ruler throughout Egypt. God put me here in this position of power to preserve life for my people. Providence, verses 5 to 8. Flag that if you haven't already done that. All right. God sent me before you to preserve life. So he told his brothers, verses 9 to 15. Let's pick up the pace just for a little bit for interest of time. What does he do in 9 to 15 now? Yeah, I want you to go tell my father all that you've seen in Egypt, all the glory of Egypt. I want you to go bring my father, verse 13, down here. Then he fell on Benjamin's neck and he wept, and he kissed all of his brothers and wept them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. I would have loved to know what that conversation was. They're standing scared to death before him, and he could have put every one of them to death, put them in prison, cut their heads off. But he embraces them, he kisses them, he weeps over them, he wants to take care of them. And after all that embracing, then they have this conversation with him. Now, beginning at 16 through 20, his brothers go back to get Jacob. So quickly, let's take a note of this, and then we're going to get into 46. Pharaoh's household heard of this, so what'd Pharaoh do? The word got over to Pharaoh himself. Joseph's family came down here. So Pharaoh offers what? Yeah, here are the carts, the wagons, literally. Here's a bunch of wagons. Take as many as you need. Take all the wagons you need and go take goods and food, and you can have the best of the land of Egypt, verse 20, is yours. And so they can have the best of the land of Egypt, verse 40. So plenty of food, plenty of ground. Get your family down here. I'm offering anything that's needed. 21 to 24, Joseph sent his brothers away to Canaan. Notice the warning that he gave them. He sent them plenty of food and garments, and he put some special money in for Benjamin. But look at verse 24. He said, see that you do not become troubled along the way. What does that mean? I'm sending you to go get my daddy and all the family that's left over and bring them back. Don't quarrel along the way. The English Standard, New Century. Perhaps, I don't know what the quarrel might be about. Perhaps it's having to do with blame for the selling him and the mistreatment of him. And I told y'all not to do that, and I warned y'all not to do that. If I hadn't rescued him, he wouldn't have been there. Don't y'all get in a quarrel. Just go get daddy and bring him back. Yeah. Joseph had to know there was a great potential for there to be a quarrel before they got back over there. He knew his brothers, that they're going to get in a fight before they get back over there. One of the things that's quite interesting to me, where you often wonder about a text and you wonder, there's no information here about it, but I wish there was. I wonder if Joseph ever told his daddy what all happened in chapter 37. You got to wonder that. Did he ever sit down before his daddy died in those 17 years and say, Daddy, let me tell you, they sold me. They put me down in a pit, and they sold me to the Egyptians, and I went to Potiphar's house. Did Jacob ever know all of that? I don't know. Text does not tell us. All right, now beginning at verse 25, let's finish this chapter. The brothers told Jacob that Joseph is alive, and what was his reaction? Verse 26, he didn't believe him. Well, they've lied about so much. They've had so many problems. I can understand that. He knew the nature of these boys, even though they're grown men now. But then they said, well, Joseph, he began to see all the carts. And notice it, verse 27, the spirit of Jacob, their father, revived. He began to see evidence. Okay, you say my son is alive and he sent all these carts. And look at all these carts. These are obviously Egyptian carts or wagons. And Israel said, it is enough. My son is still alive. I will go see him before I die. All right, now let's get to 46. Make sense? Let's get to chapter 46 now. Chapter 45 had mentioned they were going to go to the land of Goshen. We had this on the screen a moment ago. We just didn't have it labeled as Goshen. Ramses is about right there where my arrow is. But that's where they're headed. They're headed to the land of Goshen. It was some of the best land in all of Egypt. So Jacob and his family travel. Now here again we have a providence passage in verses 1 to 7. Verse 3 is one. That Jacob takes off on the journey and he goes to Beersheba. What does he do at Beersheba? He leaves Hebron and comes down here to Beersheba before he comes on down here to the land of Goshen. What does he do at Beersheba? All right. Yeah, he got to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to God. And God said, Jacob, Jacob, and he answered, here I am. He said, I am the God. Here's your providence passage. I am God, the God of your fathers. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. God's working out his plan. So we've tried to flag several of those providence passages. That's one, if you haven't already flagged that. Now then, verse 4, I will go down with you to Egypt. You're not going down there unprotected. I'm going with you. And I will surely bring you up again. And Joseph will put his hands on your eyes. Let's take the last phrase first and then go back to the in the middle. Putting your hand on your eyes, your footnote may say, close your eyelids when you die. In other words, Joseph, you're going to go see Joseph, and Joseph will be the one to put his hands over your eyes and close your eyes when you die. He's going to be there when you die. So you're going to see him. You're going to go there. So don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. But let's look at this statement here. You're going to go down to Egypt. This is fulfilling what was said back in Genesis 15 and in verse 13. You want to turn back there just quickly. 15 in verse 13. God said to Abraham, your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs. That had reference to Egyptian bondage. Well, this is going on. They're going into Egypt. Genesis 15, 13. All right. But verse 4, I will bring you up again. There are two statements involved in that, I think, or two points to be made in that. One is, Jacob is going to come up out of Egypt, but not like he thinks. He later, we're going to see in a moment, he's going to die, and he's going to make the request of Joseph, take my bones to Hebron, and I want to be buried in the land of Canaan. Remember that? He is going to come up out of Egypt, but not as a live man, but as a dead man. I think the second part of that is actually that's a prophecy of the deliverance from Egypt. I don't think it's just saying, Jacob, you're coming. You are the head of Israel. Israel is coming out of Egypt. Does that make sense? I'm going to take you there. You're going there. I'll make a great nation of you, and I'm going to bring you back out. You're coming back out. Your bones will, and so will your nation. Make sense? So flag that just as a passage that talks about the captivity and the deliverance from captivity. So he rose from there and he took off. Now then, beginning at verse 8 through verse 27 is the listing of the people. And so we're not going to go through all of that, but we have the sons of Leah that are mentioned. We have Reuben and Simeon and Levi and Judah and Issachar and Zebulun. And these are the sons of Leah, and the total people ended up being the number of 33 at that point. Look at verse 15. All right, those who were from Zilpah, the sons of Gad and the sons of Asher, totaled up to be how many persons? Verse 18, 16. So we got 33 plus 16. And then the descendants through Rachel, there's Joseph and Benjamin. And that total was 14 at verse 22. And then the descendants through Bilhah, that is Dan and Naphtali, came to a total of 7. You take those numbers and that ends up with 70. So look at verse 27, they were 70 in all. Now let's talk about that number from a couple of standpoints. I gave a rough estimate a while ago. I think there's probably 60 to 65 people in the auditorium. We got several out. So typically we've got about 70 here. So you think about, this is about the number. So you take what we've got sitting here and add another 10 people. And that's the number of people that of Jacob's family that go into Egypt. And when they come out, there are 600,000 fighting men. That doesn't count women and children. So estimates are 1.2, 1.5 or more million. So this number becomes a large nation. That's amazing. Now we'll talk about the time frame of that. Let's talk about the 70. Exodus chapter 1 and verse 1 and verse 5 mentioned the 70 came out. Deuteronomy 10 and verse 22 mentions 70 came out. Stephen, in his defense in Acts 7, mentions 75. And that's caused a lot of consternation. How many were there? Well, and if you check the Septuagint translation at Exodus 1 and verse 5, it says 75. The Septuagint translation at verse 20 adds five grandsons of Joseph, perhaps making the 75, the 70 plus those five that the Septuagint inserts. So what's the discrepancy between the 70 and the 75? That Stephen seems to be quoting from the Septuagint translation from Exodus 1. Does that make sense? And so he's probably quoting 75 or taking this number that where the five are added in the Septuagint. I don't think there's a contradiction at all. I think it's 70 people according to the text, or if you add those five, that's 75, or the Septuagint. And I don't think there's enough information to determine whether the Septuagint was wrong in their saying 75, and or should these five be added at verse 20. Make sense? Not a big contradiction. No big deal, I don't think. All right. Now, they settle in the land of Goshen, according to verses 28 through verse 34. Now, when he meets his father, and I want to get down to verse 34 in a moment. He meets his father, comes out and weeps on his neck for a good while, the text says. And Jacob basically thought, now I'm okay, I'm paraphrasing, I got to see what I wanted. I got to see my son. Now, Joseph warned them, when Pharaoh finds out you're here, he knows you're here, he'll interview you and he'll ask you what kind of work you do. You tell him you work in livestock. That's true. And the reason for that is, look at verse 34. We're ready to flag another verse. Because a shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Well, this is another point that keeps the assimilation from taking place. God's going to use the customs or the concepts of a nation to protect his own people. So why would they? What was the abomination about a shepherd? Well, Willis suggests that the Egyptians would not eat or kill a sheep because the wolf would eat a sheep, and the wolf was thought of as a god. And so since their god eats sheep, one of their gods would eat sheep, that they could not eat sheep. And shepherds will eat sheep, and they will kill sheep. And so we don't want to have anything to do with it. It's an abomination to them, just as an idolater would be an abomination to the people of God. And so God uses that, again, to protect his people. Does that make sense? So we've already seen that earlier in chapter 43 and verse 22. All right. Now we got about 5 minutes, so let's see if we can get back on schedule by finishing up here and go to chapter 47. Pharaoh blesses Joseph's family and is blessed because of Joseph now. So what we have in the first 12 verses is Joseph's father and his brothers received the best of the land before Pharaoh. Pharaoh had told him, you just get whatever the best part of the land that you want. And so they take the land of Goshen. And in interest of time, let's jump down to verse 7. Joseph brought in his father and set him before Pharaoh. And it's interesting that as Jacob comes before Pharaoh, this session begins and ends with Jacob blessing Pharaoh. Now, what does it mean he blessed Pharaoh? Well, the scholars are all over the place on that one. It may mean that he honored him with an honorable greeting. Long live the king. May the king live long. Something of that sort. And when he leaves, may the king live forever. May God bless the king forever. It may have been something like that. I don't know. Or some suggest that it may have been a pronouncement from God of a blessing, where God is guiding him and blessing, may God bless you, or God will bless you with XYZ, whatever. The text doesn't tell us. This says he blessed him, and he blessed him. And he asked him how old he was. How old was Jacob? 130 years old at this point. Now, we're about to fast forward through 17 years, and we're about to run through that real quickly here in just a moment. Joseph situated his father in the land of Goshen, according to verse 11, and then Joseph provided his father and his mother, etc., with bread according to their number and their family. So they're well taken care of. God is taking care of his people. Now, 13 to 26, Joseph starts acquiring money. And some have argued that this was the wrong thing. This is a form of socialism. I don't believe that at all. I think Joseph is merely taking advantage of the circumstance and yet using the circumstance properly and taking care of his people by taking care of Pharaoh. Does that make sense? He's staying in good standing with Pharaoh, which means Pharaoh and his people are going to take care of his own people. Does that make sense? So what does he do? Well, he starts getting all their money. How does he get all the money from Canaan and from Egypt? By selling the grain. So people come with their money and buy the grain, and finally the money runs out. And then people say, I don't have any money to buy grain with. And so all we've got is livestock. So he starts getting their livestock. He'll take their livestock, give them food. They've got to have food. And then they run out of livestock, verse 19, and they come and they offer their land and themselves. We'll be your slaves. We'll be your servant. You can have our land. So he's acquired all of the land, basically, of Egypt. That's probably an overstatement for emphasis, not literally every inch of it, but basically he acquires all the land of Egypt. The people are the servants. They've got the livestock. They've got the money. And then verse 21, he moves the people into the cities. He redistributes the people, probably for easy distribution of food during the famine. I don't know. We're not told exactly why, but that seems to be somehow moving the people around, making it easier to distribute the food, making it easier. And then he tells the people that here's the seed, go to the land and sow it, but we want how much for Pharaoh? A fifth, 20%. We want 20%, and you bring that fifth to Pharaoh, and so he's acquiring more for Pharaoh. I take it the storyline is, before we wrap up, and we've got about 2 minutes, is that as he takes care of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh sees that he's taking care of him, then Pharaoh is going to take care of the people of Joseph's people. Does that make sense? So I don't think God's so much worried here about how well did the people of Egypt fare and Pharaoh fared, as he's taking care of Pharaoh, Pharaoh's going to take care of his people. And this is God preserving his people. Now, let's get 27 through verse 31. And Israel lived in the land of Goshen for how long? Verse 28, for 17 years. We mentioned earlier, not tonight, but in a previous study, the first 17 years of Joseph's life, he was with his daddy. And his daddy took care of him. In the last 17 years of Jacob's life, he's with his son, and his son takes care of him, for what that may be worth. He died at the age of 147. And so the time drew near that he was going to be getting close to death, and he asked his son, make me a promise, put your hand under my thigh. That was a form of taking an oath, and promise you're going to take me out of here. Don't bury me in Egypt. And he made the oath and made this. He swore, I will take you out of here. And so Jacob is going to go out as God had promised. Make sense? A lot of ground to cover. We're getting close to the end. Next week we have to wind up because we have 48, 49, and 50, and we're done with the book of Genesis. We'll stop right there.